Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Murray Kamak, host of Land of the Good Groove, for a decade. Murray remembers how useful BFM was back in the day in helping to break New Zealand artists, and also expresses his surprise at how huge urban music ended up becoming. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Murray Kamak.
Hello, how's it going?
Start off at the beginning.
I latched onto soul in the 1960s when I grew up, and I used to get this magazine called Record Mirror that was a big fan of this Stax Vault Review, a show that went through England in 1966. And I sort of bought the live albums that were put out and Otis Redding Live in Europe, and I became like a teenager a sort of obsessive Otis Redding fan, you know, obsessive like people are obsessed about, you know, crappy bands. But when I read in the sports paper, the 8 o'clock in 1967, when I was 14, that Otis Redding had died, I just didn't believe it, you know, and it wasn't until it came through in the NME, which came by, or Record Mirror, it might have been, that came by boat in those days. I didn't really believe he was dead till early the next year when I saw it from a foreign source. I was just devastated for sure. I couldn't believe it. But I became obsessed with all soul music on the Atlantic label and the Motown label, and that love of that style of music just went on right through to today, where I'm tending to just sort of more look back at jazz, funk, and even old traditional vocalists that reflect the sort of African-American experience or whatever.
How was it getting those sort of records? How would you get your hands on Motown and Stax and Vault and the Atlantic subsidiaries?
Well, most of that stuff was quite common. The problem for us as kids is that we didn't like the local pressings and the local covers. So we would import from a place called Papworth's of Nottingham. We would import our records because the British covers were nicer, and they'd come by boat through the tropics and all arrive in New Zealand warped. But we used to get our records, and friends of mine who liked rock, they would get their rock from England too, because Jethro Tull's Stand Up actually stood up when you opened it, rather than the crappy quality of the New Zealand productions.
When did you first get involved in BFM?
I'd been doing Rip It Up since 1977, and we used to sort of carry sort of promotion for the campus radio network, even when it was sort of just broadcast over the summer period or whenever, though it was not all year round broadcasting. Well, I started doing a show on Monday nights called Land of the Good Groove, and I don't know what year it was. It may have been 83, 84, I'm not sure. I have no idea. I absolutely no idea. All I know is that every male on the staff was called Andrew, so I thought that was really good because I could remember their name. We called it Land of the Good Groove, so it must have been sort of, you know, soul funk, and a lot of it was quite new. It was some of the things I played, people have tended to forget that I played. My favourite thing at one point was Bobby Brown's King of Stage. That was about an album before My Prerogative, and I'm sure I was into My Prerogative. I used to play Jody Watley, even Shalimar a little bit. So there was some pretty cheesy stuff. But there was no MyFM. And once I went to a Christmas party, like after my show had been going 5-6 years or whatever, and some guy said to me, oh, someone's going to do a radio station full time that sort of sounds like your show, you know? And I thought, an urban radio station in New Zealand, what a dreamer. And I didn't know it was suddenly on the airwaves a year or two later. By that stage, hip-hop had emerged, and the show was sort of the first show that provided an outlet for hip-hop in New Zealand. And BFM had a sort of punk bias in those days, so occasionally I'd sort of, you know, come on, and soon after 7, some jerk would ring up and say, why aren't you bloody playing? What are you playing, this sort of disco shit or whatever, you know? And why don't you play some jam? And I remember saying, if you knew anything about Paul Weller, you'd appreciate this music. And And he went and he upped the swearing competition with words that I had never heard or in combinations I couldn't counter. So I said goodbye. This band's D Train, and they came out of New York, and at that time, like early 80s, Face magazine was massive out of England, and they were obsessed with the New York sound, which was just developing. Hip-hop obviously emerged in New York, but one of the bands that everyone tended to love was a band called D-Train, and I remember reading that they had played the Face second or first birthday party in London. And in 1984, I went to New York hoping I might see D-Train, you know, but I got told as soon as I got there, oh, the last time they played New York was opening for Chic. That was a year ago, you know. But D-Train was this New York sound that I became obsessed with in the 80s. I got to see Wilson Piggott and Otis Blackwell, a few old things, and I was going to be shown around New York by the former editor of New York Rocker, and he took me to this bar where David Johansen was sort of doing a very small, almost acoustic set. Oh, he had a small band, he was doing Dusty Springfield, all these songs he couldn't sing, basically. And I was a bit of a David Johansen fan, so I went completely gaga, and this guy was going to show me all of New York, and when I was slow, I wouldn't leave David Johansen. He said, oh, we'll come over with my friends to the club in half an hour, and I just stayed there. I didn't go with his friends, so I never saw New York, and he hasn't really liked me since. But he doesn't realise that, you know, we don't sort of get someone like David Johansen performing in what's just really a small bar cafe. When I was there in New York, there was I started listening to Kiss FM, and I think it was WBLAS or something, and one of them had Shep Pettibone mixing everything, so I set everybody had boogie boxes or whatever, what were they called?
Ghetto blasters.
Ghetto blasters. Everyone had them, and if I didn't have one, I used my friend, and I taped hours of these New York radio stations and brought them back, and where I had a good half hour, I'd sometimes play them on Land of the Good Groove, and people used to like actually hearing New York radio a bit on BFM just for half an hour or so. But on the radio, and when I was there in 1984, I do believe there was something like a Madonna hit like Holiday or something, one of her really early ones, but the big song was Shannon, Let the Music Play, and it was just the sound of the city, like you basically heard it the whole time, and it was just such a massive hit. That remains, I find, one of the, you know, great songs of the 80s.
Pretending our dance is just a dance, but I see he's dancing.
When I went to New Orleans on that trip, I decided, I found in the Yellow Pages a shop that was for urban music, and I worked out where it was. So I got on the bus, and as the bus, went out into New Orleans suburbs, I realized I was definitely the only white guy. And once I got out there, this shop was actually sort of a shed in someone's front yard. The shop was, about the size of this small studio. So I bought the message there.
Oh, excellent.
Which is so weird. I'd come from New York and I bought the Sugar Hill 12-inch of the message. And the funny thing is sometimes, even though I love soul music and stuff, I mean, what do you say to someone in this little shed in an area where white people just don't normally go, really? And I had to get some change to get back on, bus ticket on the way back into New Orleans proper. And so I had to buy something at a local corner store, which was really primitive. So I bought some Dr. Pepper, seeing I was being black on the day. And one swig of it, and I thought, this is bloody awful. I had, surrounded by poverty, really, I had to just pour it in the gutter, really. I mean, what do you do with that stuff?
You didn't want to drink it.
Got back on the bus and back home where I belong, really, to a tourist area.
So when you came back to New Zealand, you brought quite a lot of records with you.
Yeah, probably hundreds, knowing me. And at the time, it was bad because it was before GST, and the customs people wanted to charge me album sort of rate of tax, which was something like 30% or 40% on a 12-inch, even though it wasn't an album. See, so you had all these arguments. It was just terrible at customs getting stuff through. The hip-hop thing, it was funny, like, I really did embrace it initially. Like, the message is just some fantastic track. And I thought the message was the pinnacle of hip-hop, and I thought it was basically downhill from then in a way. But for me personally, and I couldn't believe that hip-hop became not just a novelty, but in fact the future of music. That was no way, even though I embraced it as one of the first people on radio in New Zealand, I didn't see it as the future. I just saw it as a novelty that was obviously reflecting good content, and that with songs like The Message. I picked up a 12-inch that just combined a whole lot of songs together and stuff. I can't recall. It may have been Crazy Cuts or something. I'm not really sure, but that was quite novel at the time, you know. And I did love Grandmaster Flash's use of a variety of stuff, but I got very cynical about hip-hop, and once Public Enemy were playing at Logan Campbell Centre, and I just very tired and cynical on a sort of Monday night, or I may have moved to Wednesday by then, but I was cynical about Public Enemy and just said, oh, if anyone wants to go and see a wife beater, Flavor Flaves with Public Enemy at the Logan Campbell Centre on. And the phone went a few minutes later and some kid rang up, and he was obviously quite young and quite pissed off by what I said. And he said, so what you're saying is that if James Brown came here, you wouldn't go and see him. And I said, yeah, you're right. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I think I tried arguing. He just put bullets in the sort of engine compartment of the car or something. But I'm sure he did beat the wife too, yes. Mm. Yeah, well, I must admit about my favourite track now is Apache. By Sugar Hill Gang.
Of course it's me, a better known as the Master G. A fucking new squad, sense the danger. When it's stung by the rapping ranger, had a little talk with my medicine man. He said, get them squads fast as you can. To all you girls that wanna join my tribe, just move to my rhythm and feel my vibe. Put up a fuss in the air, you'll agree. But when you come inside my TV, as I said before, you can sense the danger. When you're stung by the rapping ranger, with silver and I take a ride. All you chicks better step aside. I steal the squalls, then run away.
Ho!
Silver is what I'll say.
Ho!
Finger popping to the break of dawn. Keep it rocking.
like the stuff that we call me.
What's that?
Hot buttered popcorn. You just hip a hop a dip a pop a bang the boogie. You're wicked, bet you wanna boogie again. You can put me to the test at your request. I rock you out of your moccasins. Kimasada got down, took off his mask. He kicked off the shoes and did the monster mash. Tonto came along, saw what was happening. His head began to bop and his foot started to pat and go slam. Dunk, do the jerk. And with the mic is how my smoke signals work. They were jamming off a record that said it best. Now what you hear is not a test.
Oonga, 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 oonga. Oonga, oonga, oonga.
Sugar Hill Gang, the very old school track.
Yeah, it was interesting. Throughout the decade, hip-hop continued to grow, and when I went on a trip in 1986 to see Genesis in Philadelphia, I brought back the first Run DMC album, and I had this kid phoning me up asking for specific tracks, and it's nice to get feedback and requests, and then I realized he was just asking me for the album tracks. He had a list of them and he was trying to get them all
so he could record them.
And of course I was music industry conservative in a funny sort of way, and I sort of said, oh no, home taping is bad, I won't play anymore. And then a few minutes later his father phoned and said, my boy wants you to play a track, why won't you play it for him? And I told him home taping was killing the industry, I think.
You also got involved with some local hip-hop artists around that time too.
I recorded MCO Jane Rhythm Slave and Up Posse, and there's some, obviously there was some good tracks we made there, so that was sort of quite fun. But it was weird. As I said earlier, I didn't actually see a big future for hip-hop. I was still treating it as a novelty, probably the novelty of Maori language or Maori culture being involved, and then the novelty of almost Kiwiana with MCO Jane and Rhythm Slave. I don't mean in a itself, dismissive way. I mean in a Kiwiana way, in the sense of Sam Hunt or Barry Crump or whatever. I don't have any great love of foreign hip hop, but I find New Zealand hip hop is just sort of a part of our own culture or part of the Pacific identity. I do recall Simon Griggs' show, BPM show or whatever it was called, running parallel to mine for several years with a focus more on just what was in the dance clubs. And at the point where I sort of gave up doing Land of the Good Groove, I sort of thought that the artists I was interested in had one thing in common. They're all older than me. I was interested in the new Al Green and George Clinton and stuff. And I'd really lost any interest in what was new that was coming out. Obviously, my FM was on the air, so there was no need to play the new Albie Shore, and what was coming out from the R&B scene no longer interested me either. It became dominated by really, I think, crappy producer songwriters like Jam and Lewis. And the 80s was great for labels. Like, I was obsessed by everything on 4th and Broadway, because even though it was dance music and sort of dance culture and sometimes hip-hop and sometimes Britain, sometimes the stuff could come by from anywhere, a lot of it was sort of quite commercial in the sense that it wasn't niche music, somebody else's. 4th and Broadway was a label I always looked at, and I love the Sly and Robbie stuff, and I love Jocelyn Brown. There was Misha Paris, lots of good stuff, but the one I've chosen is Trouble Funk, because Go-Go at one point in the 80s was going to be the next big thing, and I thought that was the future, but I picked the wrong style. The Island label out of the UK, they did promote reggae and sort of make it their own almost in terms of selling reggae to a Western audience for a while. And they tried to do the same thing with Go-Go, make that Washington style their own and monopolize it. But it didn't work. But I'm still a big Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers fan. I like the group EU, and Trouble Funk, a bit boring, but I did like the way Island, with this track Woman of Principle, did, I think they were working with Bootsy on it, did sort of try and bring them a little bit into an accessibility that could have potentially taken them to a wider audience. some people sort of say, you know, how do you sort of, you know, relate to rock and soul music and stuff? And that, in a way, I don't listen to rock much at all now, but in the 80s, a lot of the soul music or artists like Prince and that had quite a rock element to it anyway, because a lot of the black musicians wanted to play rock, but the USA industry was just so regimented in terms of what either race could do. If you had to be Jimi Hendrix or white to play rock. And at one point, Chic sent a demo into a major record label in New York as a rock band, and the label just loved it and then asked them to come in. And when they came in and these black men walk into the room, the record exec just said, "Is this some kind of a joke? What are you doing? Is this some kind of a joke?" You know, and called security and got them thrown out, you know. And then, of course, they, with other frustrations that are almost race issues, they couldn't get into Studio 54 and they wrote the song F Off, which it became Freak Out. Yeah, but it originally was F Off. But they wanted to play rock, really. You know, and Nile Rodgers went on to work with NXS as a producer and that. But I was just saying the rock was in the 80s stuff and you know, Prince's stuff. I adored everything on Paisley Park, and Jill Jones was one of my picks. And the track I've chosen from her has sort of that Prince rock element as well as the funk.
Yeah.
Jill Jones. What happened to her?
Oh, last I saw, she was a backing singer for Chic, but I just don't know. Haven't a clue. She was one of those talents I thought was going to be really big. I've definitely backed a few losers in my time. I'm at the moment just obsessed by music from the past, but there's almost a good reason for that, is that years ago it was very hard for me to hear soul music. I'd have to read about it in a newspaper or a music paper and order it from overseas. Now I can listen to it on YouTube, and everybody's reissuing stuff I'd never heard of in the 70s and 80s, and I can buy a brand new sort of reissue for $10 on vinyl. It's just this fantastic opportunity to explore the past, so I don't feel negative about my doing that. I've just bought an LP from Breakwater, which I heard first from the fact that they were sampled by Daft Punk a few years ago, and I just was looking at a list of new reissues, and there's a French funk band called Cain and Abel that I've, you know, been able to listen to on YouTube, and they sound really good. And obviously a couple of years ago I discovered Simonde, which I certainly never heard back in the day, and I now own about 3 vinyl albums and 2 CDs, and they're just one of the best things from that era, even though in their day they were on an independent label and they were a flop, but it's great music. And the later Jackson stuff, there's some good stuff. You know, when I was a late teen, I of course couldn't consider taking too seriously a teeny bop act, as we would have called them in the day, and they did these final tracks. I was sourcing that off a harmless, you know, DJ double album with a few fantastic tracks pressed, you know, really well. And
BFM is 40 years old this year. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it's a fantastic achievement, because it has just been so important for the development of New Zealand music that BFM's provided an alternative to what's been programmed on mainstream. And it's helped the development of New Zealand culture, when a lot of mainstream radio just has stuff that makes you want to puke in terms of its quality, you know what I mean? You know, I mean, last time mainstream radio had a really good hit single was the Pussycat Dolls, wasn't it?
Well, I don't even count that one.
I wish your girlfriend was hot like me. Well, I think that was the last good commercial single I've heard. Maybe there's been one since then. By the way, I just wanted one of my achievements. I'm proud of this achievement, was to bring to New Zealand the continuous music mix. And what happened was I'd leave the Rip It Up office possibly about 1:45, then I'd drive to Jervois Road and get some takeaways, fried rice, special fried rice. Then I'd drive to BFM and probably arrive after 7, and there would be this young DJ very angry with me because he had a life and I didn't. And so I would just basically, you know, join about 4 or 5 12 inches together because I was eating my fried rice, you know. So that's how I developed the
continuous music mix.
Not that it was mixed very well, but at least it was continuous.
That's a great claim to fame.
Yeah.
Thanks, Murray.
Oh, I was just thinking, like, what did I play in the 80s that I probably don't play now in a way, or don't. And to some extent, Jill Jones, it's a bit heavy sounding. And I did just remember how big Sylvester was back in the day. So I dug out a track, one of his final sort of attempts at a big single, Rock the Box. And at the time, I thought it was the future of music, and maybe I was wrong yet again, but Rock the Box.
Thank you. Better keep the music jamming. Better rock your box. All over Manhattan, from Brooklyn to the Bronx, y'all better keep the music popping. Rock your box.
What are you keeping yourself busy with these days?
I'm doing a Soul Finger, the show on George FM on Tuesday afternoon, and I'm DJing Saturdays, usually on a Saturday, at CAC, the Colonial Ammunition Company bar and restaurant in Normanby Road, Mount Eden. So I do that from about 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Soul, jazz, funk, whatever, bit of stuff. And I really enjoy that because it's... there's just so much great vinyl you can buy now, and beautiful sounding reissues, and DJ quality three tracks a side, double reissues. It's just like, it's really a better way to experience the 70s and 80s now than it was then.
That's it. You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society. a weekly documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast at 11 a.m. every Saturday morning and is also available as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced by Dubhead.